Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to a book about Roxy Laybourne. She was a trailblazing scientist. Her mantra was, do the work, keep your mouth shut, and they will respect you. And eventually, I think Roxy would tell you her colleagues did in the end, and she would tell them exactly what she thought too along the way. Anyway, that's what we one of the things I learned when I read Chris Sweeney's book. Chris is a journalist, an author. His new book is titled "The Feather Detective: Mystery, Mayhem, and the Magnificent Life of Roxy Laybourne." And I hope you'll join in the conversation as we move along today. Maybe you've had a chance to read it. Maybe you haven't. I know I have a lot of listeners interested in birds and feathers. And I hope you'll join in with your conversation. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Chris Sweeney, thank you for joining us today. It's going to be a treat talking with you.
Thanks so much for having me. Thrilled to be here.
How did you first discover Roxy Laybourne, the woman this book is about?
I write a lot about birds. I report a lot about birds. And in 2016, around then, Audubon Magazine sent me out to Ashland, Oregon to visit the National Fish and Wildlife's Forensics Laboratory. It's this amazing place where they do all types of forensic analysis, be it ballistics, genetics, or morphology, to investigate wildlife crimes. And I was there to profile then the man who was in charge of the ornithology work there was a guy named Pepper Trail. And, you know, first night I met Pepper, I kind of just asked him, I said, hey, you know, how did you get into this field and how did you even learn this was a thing? And he started telling me the history and he mentioned all this whole field of forensic ornithology traces back to a little unusual woman at the Smithsonian named Roxy Laybourne. I wrote the name down, stuck in my head, thought it'd be a good story idea, did some poking around on the internet, found out she was at the Smithsonian for a long time. There were some archives. But then I kept reporting for Audubon, doing stories here and there. And a few years after meeting Pepper Trail, Audubon sent me to the Everglades to write about invasive reptiles, those giant Burmese pythons we hear about, and what they're doing to birds. And those things are devouring birds. But it turns out, take a dead bird out of a snake stomach, it's really hard to identify what kind of bird. It's just a big muck of feathers and guts. And so one of the researchers in Florida mentions to me, yeah, you know, we often send our bird remains up to the Smithsonian to be ID'd by this woman named Carla Dove. And I was like, Carla Dove is a great name for a woman who works on birds. So I gave her a call, and I had not talked to Carla Dove at that point. And she said, hey, where are you calling from? I said, I live in Boston. She said, you know, my mentor, a woman named Roxy Laybourne, the first case she ever worked was an airplane crash right in your backyard, right in Boston Harbor. And at that point, everything kind of just felt a little serendipitous. And I became really committed to learning more about Roxy and her story.
Well, I'm telling you, you have a very entertaining and lively story. It is such a fun read, because you kind of cover her whole life. And at the same time, I'm sort of reminded about a lot of things like the Smithsonian itself and how it got going and the plane crashes and so forth that were taking place back in the 60s, which kind of led to some of her work. So it's really a fascinating story. How did she, maybe let's start at the beginning with her a little bit. She grew up in, she was born in 1910. And she lived a long, long life. But growing up, she was in rural North Carolina and was the oldest of 14, I think, siblings.
Yeah, something about that, including three consecutive sets of twins. So she came from this massive family. They lived in rural North Carolina. You know, they weren't poor, but they weren't wealthy, you know, kind of middle class at that time. Her father was an auto mechanic at the kind of the dawn of the motoring age. And so she had this kind of mechanical brain, I think. She had an engineering kind of mind. She also loved nature. She would, as a young girl, she would just go hike through rural North Carolina all the time. She was asking her grandmother for help identifying birds. But then in, you know, around college, she went to Meredith College and she started becoming pretty obsessed with aviation. She even cut class one time to see Amelia Earhart come into North Carolina, and she got busted and got scolded by the dean for doing so. But so she wanted to fly. She wanted to be a pilot. And her dad wasn't crazy about that and figured out how to kind of put the kibosh on her going to ground school to learn how to fly. So she, you know, kind of kept at it. She maybe thought she'd become an engineer, but she was also turned out to be a pretty good taxidermist. And one of her first jobs out of college was unpaid, but she was working at a small North Carolina museum preparing specimens and doing taxidermy work. And that's kind of how she got into this.
It's an amazing story. And to become... to become an ornithologist, the first forensic ornithologist, I mean, that, what did that mean at the time?
It didn't mean anything. You know, this was not a field that existed until Roxy really started pushing it. And what had happened was she got pulled into this world, like I had mentioned, with the airplane crash here in Boston. 2 years after that, another airplane goes down over Maryland. That one was caused by swans that hit the airplane while it was about 5,000 feet altitude. Swans nailed the rear of that airplane, caused it to essentially break off the tail, and that plane went down, killed everyone. So Roxy started figuring out these ways of taking, you know, the tiniest bits of bird feather. Imagine a bird feather being sucked through a jet engine, what you're left with. It looks like pocket lint. Yeah. Birders have a hard time identifying birds that are perched in trees that are living in, you know, fully well birds. And Roxy figured out a way. She started looking at the microstructures of feathers, these tiny little things called barbules. And she figured out patterns, and she could say, hey, this is a gull and this is a hawk. So she started developing this method. And most of her early work at that time, you know, focused on airplane strikes and birds getting hit by airplanes. But then somewhere along the way, the Smithsonian has this rich history of working with federal agencies to help, you know, whatever it is, whether it's the FBI or Department of Agriculture. And someone came to Roxy and said, hey, we've got a murder victim, and a woman put a pillow over her husband's head and pulled the trigger. We need to show that the feathers from the barrel of the gun match the feathers taken out of this poor guy's skull. Lo and behold, Roxy could do it. And then criminal cases started piling up, and there was more murders and kidnappings. And that's kind of how she became a forensic ornithologist.
Oh, man, it's a great story. Let's back up a bit. When she got out of, because I think it's really interesting that how the whole thing got set up. When she graduated, and by the way, and this we'll get to this later, but she was also did some drama, which had an impact later on. We'll talk about that as we move along here. But she started working as an unpaid employee at the North Carolina State Museum.
For 5 or 6 years, she was unpaid. This was not a big museum, but it had a little bit of a payroll. And, you know, there's a lot of sexism. Imagine sexism. 1930s, 1940s. You're dealing with a lot of sexism if you're a woman trying to work in any science, pretty much any field, to be honest. But Roxy kind of saw this as an opportunity. She was interested in she was interested in biology. Imagine getting your foot in the door at a museum and getting behind the display cases and figuring out the art of museum making. And this was a real opportunity to do that in North Carolina. So she committed herself fully to this. And at some point, her boss said, all right, you can do some freelance taxidermy work on the side to make some coin. But, you know, we're not paying you. And then eventually, after many years of this unpaid, we'll call it an apprenticeship, but even that's maybe being a bit friendly, the state appointed her, and she was the first woman taxidermist to hold this type of position in North Carolina. And that was a big deal. The pay was still crummy, but it was a big deal for her.
Yeah, and she had to live, so she made the money on the side by doing a lot of other things. I mean, she was working like, it felt like 24 hours a day. It wasn't, but it felt like it as I was reading.
You know, this is something that anyone who tried to train under Roxy, and there were a few people that successfully trained under Roxy, but anyone who knew Roxy talked about her work ethic to me. And I'm talking, you know, 10, 12-hour days, 6 days, 7 days a week. She was often in the Smithsonian on Saturdays and Sundays. A lot of this feather identification, you know, she was pioneering this, and it took a long time to prepare the specimens, get them under a microscope. She'd have to wander through the Smithsonian's giant collection looking for, you know, maybe this is a shrike or maybe this is a horned lark. So she had to pull all these specimens, prepare the specimens, do the slides and comparison. This was slow, tedious science that she just ground it out.
She did indeed. We're talking with Chris Sweeney today about his book, The Feather Detective: Mystery, Mayhem, and the Magnificent Life of Roxy Laybourn. Questions, comments for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking with Chris Sweeney, journalist and the author of the book, The Feather Detective: Mystery, Mayhem, and the Magnificent Life of Roxy Laybourn. Give a call with your own thoughts, questions, comments at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. One of the things I loved about your book were some of the side stories that pop up, one of them relating to the Smithsonian. And I don't know, either I'd forgotten or I never knew it in the first place, how the Smithsonian came to be, and I think that's worth a comment.
Yeah, this was one of the more interesting kind of aspects of researching this book, right? I have been to the Smithsonian as a child. Even later in life, I went and visited it a few times. It's such an institution, but many people don't recognize the history of this place. And really what happened was there was a British guy, James Smithson, quite a bright scientist. You know, this goes back centuries, though. He never set foot in the United States. He made a small fortune. He came from an affluent family over in the UK. And he was a bit of a bon vivant and kind of going around Europe and having a good old time and doing a lot of research. He was an analytical chemist, smart guy, made a fortune, dropped dead in Italy. And in his will, it said something to the extent of, you know, he's going to leave his fortune to the United States to found an institution for kind of educating and dispersing science throughout the world. And this baffled a lot of people. A lot of people all over in the UK, you know, didn't want this fortune leaving to come to the colonies or to the United States, the former colonies. And there was some kind of contention in the US Congress over whether we should take this money. Some senator at the time said, you know, we shouldn't be taking money from whippersnappers like this. And it's just a crazy little history of this place that helps educate so many Americans nowadays and does such pioneer, you know, supports so much brilliant research. To think it all came from this man who never even stepped foot into our country. It's a remarkable origin story.
And it was a pile of money.
It was. It was about, I believe, 2% of the federal budget at that time, which, if you think about that in scale, it is a remarkable sum.
And the goal was collecting everything, including bird life, animal life.
Yeah, the Smithsonian's collections are vast. If you look at the Smithsonian now, it's really more than a dozen museums, and you could find everything in there from priceless artwork to, I believe there's a Confederate soldier's boot, all types of quirky bits of history. But the bird collection is remarkable. It's hundreds of thousands of specimens. And these specimens are really important. They support researchers. Researchers come to the Smithsonian every day to utilize, whether it's, you know, going into the insect collection or the tick collection or the bird collection. This is a very valuable research for scientific research.
And she landed after what, 5 or 6 years? Where, how did this all work out? I think did she go with the U.S. Fish Commission first, or I'm trying to remember.
She was doing a little bit of work on Pivers Island, which is little island, Barrier Island off North Carolina. But she got called up to the Smithsonian, or landed at the Smithsonian, because essentially World War II had siphoned off a good portion of the Smithsonian's workforce. A lot of the men went overseas. And at the time, their bird collection was falling into a state of disrepair. They didn't have the hands to, you know, prepare specimens and repair specimens. And so one of Roxy's mentors or professors down in North Carolina had a connection, knew the Smithsonian needed a taxidermist, and kind of floated this idea to Roxy. And she pursued it. She got to Washington, D.C. and found that the bird collection was in rough shape. And so she started repairing some of these bird specimens. And, you know, there was one that she found, I believe it was the bird was stuffed with caribou fur. So somebody, you know, must have prepared it in the field and had some caribou sitting around. So they just stuffed it in the bird. And another one she recalled opening up and finding an artist palette knife. And she could never figure out if it was a cruel joke on the artist or somebody just got confused and left the palette knife inside the stomach of a bird, but never could figure that one out.
And she was really good at taxidermy. And I think you said something like, or you reported that she, in her year, her first year, she did something like 369 birds.
Yeah, she could crank through these specimens, it seemed, a lot faster than most. And she was laser focused. And I think part of the laser focus came down to the fact that she had walked into a boys club, right? This was men with taxidermy, fleshing knives and exotic animal carcasses and arsenic and all types of chemicals, surrounding them. So it was certainly kind of that masculine environment. And Roxy fit in, but she was focused and she wanted to outwork her peers. And I think she did. And she certainly impressed her manager in the first few months. I found a kind of gushing letter about how she was breathing new life into these specimens in the Smithsonian.
And she was married at that time. The marriage wasn't going well.
The marriage was not going well. She had married a guy in North Carolina who turned out to have quite a drinking problem and was nowhere near as ambitious as his wife. And I often kind of thought about the dynamics of being in a relationship where your wife's the breadwinner. And, it was kind of dark. I found an oral history with one of her colleagues at the Smithsonian who recalled Roxy coming into work with bruises on her body. And this was not a time when people would talk about this, but this man was concerned and really had some choice words about Roxy's husband at that time. She left him. That was the good news, is she got away from that guy and went out on her own.
Yeah, and wound up with another guy.
Wound up with a fellow Smithsonian taxidermist. and I think much to both of their surprises, ended up pregnant in her 40s, much later in life, out of wedlock. Her second son came along out of the second marriage. And she really loved this guy. E.G. was how he was known, E.G. Laybourne. And that was true love, I think, Roxy. And I talked to some of her proteges who, Roxy didn't talk much about personal life, but they all knew that was really her partner there.
Yeah. And it was this, I think he was in his 60s and she was 40 or more. So it had to have been quite a surprise.
Very much so.
when that youngster came along. You write that Roxy's move to the Smithsonian was from a regional museum was kind of like a ball player from AA farm team getting pulled into the starting lineup of the Yankees. And they didn't, the taxidermists, as I recall, they had decided before she got there that they that she should be housed in the, something about the size of a closet.
Yeah, they really didn't want her coming into the taxidermy studio. Roxy recalled this in one of her interviews that, you know, on the first day there was all this sticker in a storage closet up on the, you know, third floor. They just, it was a masculine kind of place, and having a woman in there was going to cramp their vibes. But it turned out they all ended up loving Roxy, and Roxy loved those guys that she worked with for the first few years there. They formed this really special relationship, and Roxy was just one of the boys, so to speak, after a while.
Well, I think she proved herself to those.
Absolutely. Yeah, she really showed that she could do the work and do it better than a lot of the men surrounding her.
Do the work, keep your mouth shut, and they will respect you.
That mantra, man, she lived by that for maybe a little too long. And then I think she got confident and old enough to break out on her own and not keep her mouth shut so often.
Let's talk more about how she became an authority on feathers. What was it about feathers that fascinated her?
You know, she had spent so much time in the bird collection. And when you're in that environment, you're handling is at the Smithsonian, you have access to probably 90% or more of the known species in the world. So she was just constantly handling birds from all around the world. And you do that, you start to get a feel for feathers. You start to see details that you'll never see through a pair of binoculars or a spotting scope. And so she had this understanding of bird anatomy and feathers, but it really wasn't until this airplane went down in 1960 off Boston that it all clicked together. And they said, oh, we need to start understanding what birds are getting hit by airplanes. And one of the kind of steady pieces of evidence we have is feathers. And that's where her obsession began. And I'd just like to note, she was 50 years old at that time. She was 50 years old when she started working on feather identifications. I hope we all are able to take on new challenges at 50, because that just blows my mind.
It blows my mind as well. And you kind of had a little sidebar, sort of, on the airline industry at the time in the 60s, where the emphasis was on pleasure and so forth when you got on the plane.
Yeah, I think safety came second in those days. You know, we're all accustomed to getting the lecture of, you know, where the exits are and how to blow up your vest should something go wrong. I think they were popping bottles of champagne and really making it a customer-centric experience. This was the tail end of the golden age of flight, where travelers were a bit spoiled, but airlines were also dealing with some serious safety issues at that time, let alone all the hijackings. You know, this was a totally different age of flight. And so there were some, you know, a lot of safety problems with some of these airlines. One of the airplanes, the Electra that went down in Boston Harbor, they couldn't figure out if it was birds at first because the airplane had suffered an enormous amount of crashes, including two in which the wings just ripped off mysteriously midair and plummeted to the ground and killed everyone. So this was, you know, the golden age of flight, but maybe not the safest age of flight.
Yeah. And there wasn't at that time, to begin with, at least, there wasn't a lot of thought that birds really created much of a problem.
Not at all. The military knew this a little bit. The military had done some projects on Midway looking at albatrosses that were sort of a hazard to some of their pilots. But the commercial airlines were not paying attention to the bird threat. The FAA was in its infancy, certainly wasn't paying attention to the bird threat. And even after this bird strike in Boston, they kind of chalked it up to a freak accident and said, look, you could replicate this scenario 100 times and that airplane's not going to go down. The engines will come back in time. And then 2 years after, you know, right after that Boston investigation was closed, another airplane went down, that one because of the swans, totally different circumstances. And I think at that point, regulators realized, birds are way bigger of a threat than we realized, and we need to do something about this.
And she was tasked with figuring out what birds were causing the problem. And as you said, I mean, she'd look, she would look at birds that they had on hand there, but then she got studying the feathers themselves and the barbules.
Yeah, so if you look at a feather, hold one in your hand, and you can kind of see it's a branching pattern. It has a main kind of line running up the rachis, and then it branches out. And then when you put those under a microscope, you pluck off a little tidbit of the tip of the, you know, the barb, the feather barb, and that's where you'll put that under a microscope, and it's remarkable. There's all these cell junctures and pigments and little hooks and villi. It doesn't look anything like a bird feather, to be honest. You start to think, this is what my eye can't see. Under a microscope, a bird feather is a very remarkable thing. And that's where Roxy, you know, made her payday, essentially, was figuring out, hey, all these microstructures are distinct among different families of birds. So, you know, how the pigment aligns or how these cell junctures align or these nodes and villi, they're all different among different families. And Roxy figured out kind of a mental algorithm, actually, to start recognizing the patterns in these microstructures.
Yeah, you've got some cool photos in the book of those barbules. They're really fascinating. And you're right, they don't look at all like a feather under the microscope.
Yeah, you see those microscopic pictures and you're thinking, this is a bird feather? How could that be? But That was what Roxy stared at day in and day out and really learned everything about them.
The occasion came up finally for her to be presenting, be an expert witness. And talk about those first, I think the first couple.
Yeah, so she started getting called into courtrooms, and these were for some violent crimes. I'm talking murders, suffocating by pillow. Poor woman up in Maine was suffocated. The pillow burst and sent feathers all over the crime scene, and the murderer took off, but they found some feathers on his clothes. Another was an assault. And then there were some also tragic airline crashes. In one, a loon went through the windshield of a Learjet and decapitated the poor pilot. And that became a lengthy piece of civil litigation that Roxy was called in to be an expert witness. So she had to take the witness stand under some high pressure circumstances. She was often grilled by defense attorneys who were trying to undermine her science or paint her to not be this expert, but just, you know, some pseudoscientist, will say. So Roxy had to learn how to stay on her toes while on the witness stand and, you know, deal with what was being thrown at her, which she could never anticipate.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that the first couple, she was sort of all the facts, and she always stayed with all the facts, but the manner that she presented those facts was she thought about that. I think she lost the first two, went sort of the wrong way, and then they probably should have gone. But she drew on her back to her college days at Meredith College.
She was in the theater troupe at Meredith, and she loved it. And I even found an old review of She Stoops to Conquer, I believe, is the play that she starred in, and it got a very favorable review back in the 1929. But anyways, as she started testifying in court under these high pressure circumstances, she went back to her acting days and she said to herself, you know, you are an actor up there. Just put the mask on and get the message across to the people that need to hear it, the jurors and the judge. And so it was, you know, be truthful, be concise, don't show off how much you know. That was something she was really big on when she was on the stand. Don't try to make your, they don't need to know that you've done all this great work, Roxy. Just focus on getting the message across and the evidence explained in a way that they could digest it. And so she went back to her acting days and kind of got herself in the right headspace to put on these performances.
And I did you ever figure out how many that she did? How many times she, I don't remember reading that.
No, I don't know how many times she testified in court. I highlighted, the ones that I could find, and there were certainly ones that I found that were maybe just not as interesting, or I couldn't find the corroborating material. And there's also maybe a few really exciting cases that she talked about in these oral history interviews that I found that I just couldn't find the corroborating evidence in the news. And once she claimed that she went undercover at a Boy Scouts jamboree to kind of inspect feathers to make sure, you know, that they weren't using any feathers from protected birds in their arts and crafts projects and trafficking. And I was like, I have to find this. Did Roxy really go undercover at a Boy Scouts jamboree? I could never corroborate that. So it's not in the book. And I still think about it.
You mentioned the Learjet, and that was in 1981. She identified a common loon as the species that crashed through the windshield of a Learjet, killing—actually, it was the co-pilot, I think. Because the pilot somehow managed to land with a horrific scene just to his right.
Yeah, that's true. That's a horrible case.
A horrible case. And the guy who was decapitated was a young guy, married, with one or two kids. And so there was a trial. And the significance of the size of the loon was interesting. Tell that story.
Yeah, so they needed to figure out how much this bird weighed, because that was the crux of this lawsuit was, you know, this did the airplane's windshield meet certification standards? At the time, I want to say, the time this Learjet came off the production line, according to the court documents and court transcripts, there was no standard. The Learjet of this, you know, there was no regulation stipulating that a bird had the windshield had to withstand a strike from a bird of 4 pounds or 8 pounds or whatever it was. But the defense attorney was really going after Learjet on its windshield. And Roxy said this was an enormous loon. This was, according to Roxy, this was a common loon that weighed 11 and a half pounds. She believes it had beefed up for migration. It was, in the fall, so it aligned. She found lots of fat on this bird. She got a fair bit of bird remains to analyze in this case. There was a lot of fat. And so Roxy and Learjet's attorneys were arguing, this was an 11 and a half pound bird. This is about a freak accident, as you can imagine. And the defense attorney, the attorney for the family, was saying this was not an 11 and a half pound bird. This was a much smaller bird, maybe 4.5 pounds. And so Roxy got hammered on the stand on that. That was one of the most brutal cross-examinations she underwent, was testifying. And this was a top-tier attorney, litigator that the family had bought in. And he really went after Roxy on this case. And Learjet lost. Learjet did not win that case. They said, nope, Learjet was at fault. They awarded $1.5 million to the family, I believe. But what struck me is I found one of the junior attorneys in that case. And she said, Chris, I have this very clear memory of waiting in the hallway after that decision was rendered. And I asked a few of the juror members if they would talk to me. And lo and behold, according to this attorney, all the juror members believed Roxy. They believed that this was an 11 and a half pound bird. They just couldn't fathom giving the family nothing. And so they ruled in favor of the family and not in Learjet. And that really irked Roxy, really irked her. She never got over that.
Yeah. And well, in the first place, she had she couldn't believe that they wouldn't believe her. Especially given the person who had said it was 4.5 pounds. Who had nothing like the experience she had.
Total lack of ornithological experience. But, I can kind of, if I put myself in the juror's shoe, I understand that quandary. This was a tragic accident, family grieving, wife pregnant at the time that this poor pilot was killed. But, man, Roxy was so upset that the jury ruled against her kind of science, and she said that was it. I'm never doing civil litigation again. And I believe she stuck by it. I don't think she ever did any civil litigation after that.
Yeah, I think you're right. You talked about her work on saving whooping cranes. You know, we have here the International Crane Foundation in Wisconsin. So cranes are often on the minds of our listeners. But talk about that whole story surrounding whooping cranes, hoopers.
Larry, I love this story because Roxy never really talked about this. And when she was asked about it much later in life, she downplayed it and said, I just played a small part. What happened was, early 60s, whooping cranes are in perilous situation. They were really teetering on the edge of extinction. There were very few left in the wild, very few in captive breeding programs. And so U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wanted to figure out how to improve their captive breeding efforts. No one knew how to identify the sex of a whooping crane at that time. Was it a male or female? So Roxy gets called in to help with the whoopers, and they say, hey, we think there's a way to get up in the cloaca, and there might be some determinants of sex there. So Roxy started first working with sandhill cranes before moving on to whoopers, and she created what was dubbed a cloacoscope, which was kind of a way to pry open the cloaca. And she determined that you could see this pea-sized oviduct on females and these kind of bumps on males. And she spent a long time working on this. She traveled around the country. She visited zoos to work first to refine her sexing technique on cranes. And then she went out west to practice on live sandhill cranes. And then she finally gets to Texas, where there was a whooper in captivity, and she sexed that and did it, was able to confirm it was a female, I believe. And then she goes to the zoo in New Orleans that had the most whooping cranes in known at that time. And the guy wouldn't let her touch his cranes. He was this bombastic zoo owner who kind of had some luck with a captive breeding program, but he wouldn't even make time to talk with Roxy, wouldn't come out and speak with her, blew her off the entire time. She had to return to DC and say, I couldn't do it at the New Orleans Zoo. The guy just wouldn't let me touch his cranes. All this happened, and then Roxy validated her method, though. She wrote a report on this, an internal report for Fish and Wildlife. She developed this cloaca scope so that she could actually see up the bird's cloaca where the sun doesn't shine and get a real good look at the anatomical structures that she determined were sexing whooping cranes. And then I found this press release from Fish and Wildlife at that time, kind of never mentioned Roxy by name, didn't mention a female, just said a young scientist has developed a method for identifying the sex of cranes. And I was like, oh my God. This is remarkable science. And like I said, all these years later, she's asked about it in an oral history interview that the Smithsonian was doing. She just downplayed it. She's like, I played a very, very small part. And I beg to differ, Roxy.
And just to go full circle on the cranes, there was a female crane that finally got mated with another male.
And Roxy helped identify this crane sex, and it was misidentified. I can't remember off the top of my head if it was a male that was misidentified as a female. But this Roxy's work identifying the sex of the single crane changed the breeding program. It became one of the most prolific progenitors of cranes, and it lived a very long and healthy life and sired numerous offspring. And Roxy was the one that determined the sex of that crane.
It was an amazing story. She often had to deal with people her superiors, so to speak, at the Smithsonian. There was one guy who just didn't like her, despite all of her work. Talk about that a bit.
Yeah, this was a common thing. Roxy butted heads with middle management, we'll say. And this one in particular guy, Clyde Jones was his name. He wanted Roxy out of the museum. He didn't respect her work because in his eyes, the Fish and Wildlife Lab within the Smithsonian, this was about intrinsic ornithological research. And Roxy was doing service work. This wasn't real science. This was Roxy just helping airlines and police and, sure, might get some media attention, but this is not PhD level publisher perish type science. And Roxy didn't have a PhD. She never did earn her PhD, and that irked her a little bit in life. But she certainly made her contributions to science. So she butted heads with this guy, and unbeknownst to Roxy, actually, some male colleagues rallied behind her because the guy was trying to truly force her out of the museum and said, Roxy has essentially set up an illegal laboratory here to do feather identifications. She has no right. She should only be working on systematic red-winged blackbird research. And these three ornithologists kind of rallied behind Roxy and said, her work is essential to the FAA. And oh, by the way, she's always helping Smithsonian anthropologists and other Smithsonian researchers who come across bird feathers in their line of work and need to identify them.
Yeah, and her position was, it was weird because they eliminated the position somehow, but she still got to stay there.
This was something that confounds everybody. No one ever really knew who Roxy worked for. The situation was she was hired by the Smithsonian in the 1940s, but soon after, a few years after, transitioned to a Fish and Wildlife employee. So she was a Fish and Wildlife employee within the Smithsonian. Then she gets fired from Fish and Wildlife, sort of, and goes to a three-day work schedule to focus just on the feather, to help the Fish and Wildlife agents who needed help with feather identifications for criminal poaching cases. And then she was also freelancing at the time and doing work for General Electric and Rolls-Royce and the engine makers who were developing airplane engines and needed to know how their engines, you know, ingested birds. So Roxy had this real piecemeal employment situation that she kept totally mum because she didn't want anyone, she didn't want scrutiny. She had a family to support. She was a single mother at this time. She had to do what she had to do, but man, did she have a strange employment status.
I loved it. What, she get what, $250 per consult or something?
Yeah, that's, I found some invoices, and I can't remember if it was for GE or Pratt & Whitney, but it was from one of the engine makers, and she was charging about $250 a pop for a feather identification at that time.
Amazing story. How has aircraft design changed since Roxy started investigating plane bird collisions?
Yeah, you know, this started soon after those first crashes caused by birds in the 60s. So engine makers started figuring out they needed to make their engines more resilient and capable of ingesting large amounts of birds and large birds. FAA started improving some of its regulations around the weight of a bird that the aircraft needed to be able to withstand. But really what I think Roxy's most noticeable contributions are is if you go to an airport today, if you're at a big airport, you're very likely, you'll never see it, but there's a team of people working to keep birds out of flight paths. And I just wrote about this for The Guardian this week. I spent some time in Boston hanging out with the team whose job it is to keep birds out of flight paths. So they have air cannons buried in the grass, and they'll walk out if they see some gulls congregating near one of the runways. They can fire off an air cannon and woof, this big air blast comes out and the gulls go scattering. They have shotguns in their truck if that doesn't work. They keep, you know, really, really diligent landscape maintenance. You don't want to plant a bush that's going to start bearing berries at an airport and attract flocks of hungry birds that are going to come for the berries. You want to keep your grass short. You want to make sure there's absolutely no standing water near the airfields that are going to attract birds. And understanding what birds are being struck at an airport allows the airport managers to kind of tailor their approaches to dealing with birds.
Yeah. And despite that, there are still, I think you noted in 2022, there were something like 17,000 bird strikes.
Yeah, some more recent data has come out since, but 2023, 19,000 bird strikes at roughly 800 airports in the U.S. And I should emphasize to listeners, most of these bird strikes go unnoticed. They cause no damage whatsoever. But every once in a while, as you know, Captain Sully had to deal with, you know, these bird strikes can cause chaos and put passengers and pilots at serious risk.
She also dealt with, and she did a lot of work with the military, because
Air Force
that
still depends on her, or not on her, but on her protege. So the Air Force, the Navy, I mean, these pilots are sometimes flying single engine air. So you lose an engine there, you're in deep trouble. There have been some really tragic, unfortunate accidents that the Air Force has lost service members because of bird strikes. This is no laughing matter for them. I like to have fun, and I think Roxy's story is so entertaining. And in talking with some of the Air Force guys during this reporting, man, these guys so appreciate Roxy's work and the ongoing work of the Smithsonian's Feather ID Lab. They have, you know, when they strike a bird, they have to send in for identification. There were some really bad, including a B-1 that was struck by an American white pelican, and half the guys on that flight died. And there was a tragic accident in which a big jet taken off out of Alaska hit some Canada geese and went down and killed every member on board. So the Air Force takes this issue very seriously.
And there was even an astronaut, I believe.
Ted Freeman, 1964, during a training flight, first astronaut to die, died by a bird strike. And where did those bird remains get sent? Up to the Smithsonian for Roxy to identify.
So she started at the age of 50, and she was still going at, what, 90?
Yeah, at 90. She was working from her couch. She had her proteges. She had a few women working under her, but she was still, you know, her eyes were bad at that time. Her back was real bad, but she would almost listen to the descriptions of someone talking about the feathers that they could see under the microscope and talking about the barbules. And she's, oh, that's a gull. And she'd get up and wander over to the microscope, shuffle over to it. And she worked almost until the day she died.
It's amazing. And she loved her. She loved her work. She loved the animals. But she was peculiar in a lot of ways. She loved this horse, for example.
Oh, the horse story is just a remarkable story. She had a few horses. She lived on a nice piece of property in Manassas, Virginia, maybe 15, 17 acres, had a few horses, one in particular named Star. And her granddaughter told me this story, but I heard it from a lot of people. Star passed away, and Roxy was sad about it.
Laid with it the night it was dying.
Yeah, she really was a companion. This horse and her had this relationship. So she took her blanket out to the stable and stayed with it on the nights it was dying. And when it came time to bury the horse, this is how the granddaughter tells it. Roxy found, walked the property, found a place to bury the horse, dug the hole herself, dragged this horse over, put it in with the, dragged it over with the tractor, got it in, and then realized she hadn't dug far enough and the horse's legs were sticking up off the ground. Now, most people that love their animal like that say, oh, I gotta dig deeper. Roxy got a hacksaw out, and being a taxidermist all those years really paid off. She knew how to took those, clean the leg, clean right off, just saw through the horse's legs, called it a day.
And she was honored eventually. She received some nice honors for her work.
She did. She really became recognized both among her places of education, so Meredith College, George Washington, all alumni awards. At one point, I found some court transcripts in which she bragged about how the FAA and a few industry members gave her kind of a lifetime recognition award. But importantly, I think, is her legacy really stands out among people that know the threat birds pose to aircraft. And so here, you know, when I was talking to the Air Force guys who had known Roxy, man, does her legacy live large with some of these guys. And she got the due. I don't know if she got the recognition she deserves. I hope this book helps get her story out there and, you know, really cements her legacy. But among those who knew Roxy, she was really well respected and loved.
And how's the reception so far for the book?
Beyond my dreams so far. It's been named one of the best books of summer by LA Times and Elle Magazine and NPR. And it seems to be resonating with readers because a lot of people love birds. A lot of people love science. And you put those together with a character like Roxy at the center. I think it's a really intriguing book, and I think we all are better off from knowing Roxy's story.
I agree with you, and you've done a wonderful job writing about her. And thank you so much for taking time to be with us today, Chris. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Chris Sweeney, a journalist, and the book is titled The Feather Detective. Take a look at it. The subtitle, Mystery, Mayhem, and the Magnificent Life of Roxy Laybourn. Great to have him with us today. And, of course, it's always great to recognize our team. Clara Nyper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening, and stay with us. Lots in store here on WPR News.